This is episode alpha of the Software Freedom Law Show. Hi, and welcome to the 11th episode of the Software Freedom Law Show.
And now we actually get to show the reality that we're numbering in hexadecimal.
It's exciting.
I think it's exciting.
I don't think it's exciting.
Well, I think it's
kind of funny.
Well, but numbers are more compact. If each digit goes, to 15 places, then the numbers are more compact. Like, I figured out that we will be able to fit all of our shows ever probably into two digits.
But we don't require that efficiency, so...
I like that efficiency.
It doesn't hurt.
That's good. And we get to call them by letters instead of numbers.
That's true. I like that it's a little bit different from any other podcast that I've seen.
Yeah, why don't the other podcasts number in hexadecimal? Or octal. Octal would be fine, too. But that would make more numbers, of course. Binary would be a little bit crazy.
Binary would be really weird. I bet someone has or will be using binary numbering.
Hey, do you know I'm a member of the Computer Science Honors Society called Upsilon Pi Epsilon that I was inducted into when I was undergrad, and the seal has the year of the founding in binary.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow, that's kind of awesome.
Yeah.
Wow,
but it's 1964, which I cannot rattle off in binary, unfortunately. they don't actually make you memorize that to join the Honor Society.
Wow, that's pretty neat, actually.
Yeah, I thought it was good. See, the thing is, we shouldn't be so obsessed with numbering things in decimal. I understand why. There's this evolutionary reason that we have.
I just had the hardest time over at a party the other day explaining how binary worked. It was really weird. It was with a group of 10 people, and one guy was an astronomer, and he understood what I was talking about.
But nobody else did.
And no matter how you explain modes and bases and on and off, for some reason, people just don't get it.
Well, people have argued to me before that the obsession with decimal is genetic, basically, because we have 10 fingers and 10 toes.
Right. That we want to use base 10.
Yeah, that's what people argued. But the Mayans had like bases and subbases, and they weren't 10.
Right, the Mayans had zero, which is...
Well, they had zero, but their numbering system had different bases. It wasn't... Yep. None of them were 10, I think, or none of them were 10.
Oh, I don't know.
I thought. Somebody told me this. Anthropologist told me this once. Hmm. And I'm just sort of... Now our listeners can go look on Wikipedia and email us.
But we might have to follow up next week.
Podcast. I'll find the Wikipedia entry for the Mayan numbering system, and I'll put it in the show notes.
And it may feel like we're reaching for content. And I think we can give ourselves away now and say that we're actually going to be including a speech here.
Yeah, well, I mean, Karen's heading off for a trip, and I'm lazy. And so between those two factors, I think it made it a necessity that this episode we have to give you something we already had. But it's a really, I think, useful talk.
Definitely.
For folks.
And we're asked a lot about the topic of the speech is compliance, GPL compliance. And it's something that we're asked quite often. And I think that it's a topic that really lends itself to a prepared presentation. And I just listened to your speech earlier today, actually. And don't listen to him when he says at the beginning that it's dry and that you may want to walk out of the room. Don't believe him.
The room was actually hard to sort of crack, and get them engaged. It tends to be the case at Linux World, which is where this is recorded, that the attendees are not very familiar with free software yet. I mean, it's actually good in that way because it draws people in who've never heard about anything related to open source and free software. They've just heard the word Linux, and they haven't even been told yet, believe it or not, that it's actually the GNU system, as RMS would tell them. I mean, they haven't even heard that much, and we've all heard that 100 times from RMS in our community. But so they're very new to all topics. Every topic on every track is new to them. So I think it's very overwhelming for the attendees, and they're just trying to get, just sort of, like when you go to something new, anytime, this is true for all of us, you just want to get a few nuggets of new information because you can't process the fire hose of information. So I was trying to make them feel a little more comfortable. poll and so forth. But I think for our community,
our listeners are probably a little more sophisticated.
Much different audience of our podcast than our Linux world.
Although you can't actually hear the audience in your recording. So
no, they actually didn't laugh at the jokes, Karen. That's the fact. The truth of the matter is that
that's true or not, the question answer, which I think we may be leaving off because
we're going to leave off
quite
the Q&A
long,
and a lot of the questions.
But
were,
you can't
somewhat...
you actually can't hear the questioner.
Yeah.
So
and also the Q&A stuff I think would probably be a little too basic for our audience to some extent, because a lot of them sort of ask questions to basically repeat what had already been said in the talk. And there are slides for the talk, which will be linked to from the show notes. And after the final recording's done and we have the time indexes, I'll put time indexes into the slides for everyone. So if you want to get to a browser right now, pause now and get to a browser, and you can follow along with the slides, because there are references to the slides in the talk. So this may be one of the podcasts you have to do at your computer if you want to get the full effect of seeing the slides.
Very good.
And this is our exciting episode Alpha. And I use the NATO alphabet. I like it. At least I know it all for hacks. I sometimes forget a couple of the letters later down in the alphabet, but I know the NATO alphabet up to Foxtrot at least.
Yeah, I've heard you use it before. I never can remember.
It's good for
it.
Well, to be cool in the computer, all you have to know is to Foxtrot, because you're only using it for hacks, and that only goes to Foxtrot. So.
Right.
Anyway, and it's like a cool 20s word, you know. That's kind of.
Yeah, it just makes me think Whiskey Tango.
Yeah, Whiskey Tango, that's W&T, that's correct, Whiskey Tango. There's some other funny ones.
Foxtrot.
In there. Oh, Foxtrot because it dances. Oh, I see. But Whiskey's not a dance.
But Whiskey Tango Foxtrot.
Oh, WTF.
All right, Tango, so
now I get
on
it.
That note.
Okay, well, I was totally
we'll
lost
let you get to
joke.
This speech and enjoy.
Yeah, enjoy. The talk today is going to be about the issue of GPL compliance. This is a rather dry subject for which I apologize in advance. I've done my best to make it interesting, but I will not be offended if you start wandering out slowly but surely when you realize that level of dryness here. I think for me it's a particularly interesting subject because I've been involved with it for so long, and I think it's a central aspect to the adoption and promulgation of the ideas of freedom for software users that has been the reason I've been involved with open source and free software for most of my life. Now, this is in fact not a new topic, and GPL enforcement has been going on regularly since around 1989. It's been done in a formal way since around 2001, but recently there has been a lot of negative press about it, and people have been using it as an example of how open source is dangerous, which I don't think is actually correct. And what I hope to do is clear up some of the misconceptions that people might have about what it means to have a GPL compliance process, what GPL enforcement is, and what it means for organizations. Now, I want to briefly explain my background so you understand where I'm coming from. I got involved in GPL enforcement as a volunteer for the Free Software Foundation in 1999. Since then, I've been involved in pretty much, at least to my knowledge, every major non-corporate GPL enforcement that's occurred since then in the United States. So I have probably most of anybody in the country's experience with doing GPL enforcement from the point of view of the community copyright holder. At my old employer, the Free Software Foundation, I made the first formal GPL compliance laboratory, as we called it, that was the first program to be a formal activity of an organization to do enforcement of the GNU General Public License. And when I came over 3 years ago to the Software Freedom Law Center, I helped form a GPL enforcement team there that does enforcement for various copyright holders. We're a legal services organization. Our clients are nonprofit developers who are writing open source and free software on their own time or as part of a nonprofit activity. And we help them do a variety of different things with respect to legal services. It's actually a misconception that
GPL enforcement is a primary part of what we do, it ends up getting more press coverage because it's interesting to people and because it's one of the few things that we get the opportunity to talk about publicly. When you're a legal services organization, you are advising clients under attorney-client privilege about their issues related to copyright issues and various other things that any open source and free software project needs. GPL enforcement ends up being public much of the time, so it ends up being a thing we can talk about publicly. I should note that I am not a lawyer. I don't want to be a lawyer. I spend most of my time with lawyers, and that's enough for me. I can't give you legal advice, and even if I were a lawyer, I'd be telling you right now, I'm a lawyer, but this is not legal advice for you. So either way, it's not legal advice. The audience for this talk is actually two types of people in the world. I hope you all, and actually I probably believe all of you are in the first type, but I've designed it so that it is directed towards both groups. The first group are the ones who have a clue about the GPL. And what this means is that you've made a good plan for how to deal with free, libre, and open source software within your organization. And you've made a decision to try and learn the best practices to make sure you're in compliance with the GPL. This is just very simple and straightforward due diligence that I think everybody will see and think is the right thing to do. Unfortunately, you might have bosses who don't think this way. You might work for organizations that don't think this way, unfortunately, or you might advise them, more than likely, about issues. So there's also this other group of people who are somewhat clueless. These are the people who actually still think Dilbert is relevant, for example, and think that that's the way the world is structured. My wife told me I shouldn't use Dilbert cartoons, but my point is Dilbert is the ancient and in our world, and some people still do think that way. And they refuse to read the GPL. I've met people who just won't read it for reasons I can't begin to understand. And even worse, they don't want to know what is coming into the organization and what is under the GPL. Stormy Peters gave a talk earlier today about general practices within an organization dealing with the myriad of open source issues. And she talked a lot about what organizations need to do to overcome this problem. And so I hope that you're working for organizations that already have done this, or you are a force within your organization to overcome this kind of clueless thinking. So I'm assuming that all of you understand why it's important to worry about GPL issues and to think about what to do with regard to the open source and free software. But I've included material for you to be able to talk to the clueless and help educate them so that they can understand in the way that you do. So essentially what I'm talking about is two ways of examining the problem. You either do it up front and you say, okay, I'm going to make a plan for how to deal with GPL issues within my organization. And if you do that and you build development, software development practices around that plan, it actually makes compliance a rather easy task. Of course, there are people who are going to wait until they get a letter from a copyright holder saying that they've failed to comply with the terms of the GPL. So there's basically two different approaches to the problem, and I'm going to talk about both of them. Let's start with the one that makes the most sense, where you make a plan for best practices. I was glad that Stormy's talk was before mine, because she outlined earlier this morning all these different things that you want to do in an organization when you worry about that in a general sense. What I'm talking about here is specifically with GPL issues, because GPL remains the primary open source and free software license used. SourceForge still lists it in the high 60s or 70s percentile of all the open source that is out there. So if you're doing anything related to open source and free software or Linux, you're going to be involved with some sort of GPL software. And what I think can be done and what I encourage companies to do when they're considering including GPL or open source software in their products is to make ahead of time engineering plan about how to develop around and within the GPL space, how to integrate it properly, and even to make rules about your acquisition processes that relate to this. I'm going to try to talk about all of these in the time I have today. So the most important thing that I always try to encourage companies to think about is to treat this as a development and software engineering problem. Because most of the compliance problems that I've seen in the 9 years I've been doing enforcement have been related to some failure in the software development process where good planning was not used by engineers in working on the software. And one of the simplest things is to use revision control. And I'm amazed that I have to put this up here, but I have been discovering lately that a lot of corporate environments of software development don't actually use a good revision control system. And in particular, they don't have a system set up that has the idea of vendor branches, which is what it's called in the Subversion world. It's called other things in various different revision control systems. But the idea is when you get software from somebody else, you put it in a special place in the repository, and you keep that version pristine. It's always the version you got from upstream. And then you keep your modifications in a different branch, and you maintain those two branches in parallel so that you can always know what modifications you've made to the software as you've gone along and what version is the canonical version from your upstream. And if you do this, as we're going to see later in the talk, this makes certain parts of the compliance process a lot easier because it's much easier to understand where your engineers have modified and changed GPL software and therefore are obligated to include that in the complete and corresponding source code. The other big thing that a revision control system gives you for free is to tag your source code releases when you do a binary release. So many places and so many companies, particularly embedded software companies, fail to keep track of what source code corresponds to a binary that's in the field. I'm amazed that this engineering process is allowed to continue, but it is quite common. So make sure that you always know what the source code was for a release that you're going to put out to the public or to your customers. It's a really simple thing to do, and it will save you tremendous amounts of trouble and heartache when you have to do GPL compliance. The other key engineering problem that I've seen in GPL enforcement is there is the one person on the development team who knows how to build the software. This is particularly a problem with embedded systems, which are much harder to package and put together. If you need to build a single binary firmware in a single file that the user downloads and burns onto some hardware device, it's often very complicated to put that together into that final firmware package. And you end up having the guy in the organization that knows how to do it. Well, don't let him be the guy. Make sure that process is documented. Indeed, make sure that it's in the revision control system as well of how to do that build. Make sure that all the other engineers are cross-trained on that. And this is going to come into play in a big way in GPL compliance, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute. But if you follow these processes up front, you're going to find when we get to the later part of the talk, all this stuff is much easier to deal with. Now, if you are in the situation where you haven't been doing this stuff in the past and you haven't been keeping track of things, the best advice I can give you to go back with today is to download something like Fossology. It's an excellent project. It's an open source and free software project that helps you figure out what GPL stuff and actually all the other open source license stuff are in or is in your product. So certainly do that now and then implement these processes if you can with your engineers. And I can't stress enough that GPL compliance is so often an engineering problem. I want to shift gears and talk about this issue of what I mean by compliance. And it comes down to this interesting idea of what's happened with software in the last 30 years. It's really a strange fact, frankly, that binaries exist. They only exist for the computer, by and large. They're only there primarily so the computer can run the code that was written. That's why we have the separation of source code and binary in the first place. And that process in the history of software was used to control users, to change the rights that users got with their software because the source code was obscured from them. And of course, what we've been doing in the open source and free software world is trying to break down that wall, building our own stuff that doesn't have that kind of separation. But in fact, what's happened with the copyleft specifically, which is what the GPL is often called, a copyleft license, is that we've taken the legal mechanism that controls the distribution of software, which is copyright law, and used it to promulgate and propagate these goals that we have for the freedom of users. So what's really happening is that binaries are just additional things that are covered by copyright law. In fact, they are, under copyright law, modified versions of the source code, specifically translated from the source code language into ones and zeros for the computer to understand. And since that activity, the creation of a modified work under copyright law and distribution of that modified work is governed by that law, what the GPL does is uses that to make certain requirements on you when you take somebody else's copyrighted stuff and turn it into binaries or modify it and turn it into binaries and put certain requirements on you if you want to later redistribute or do other sorts of things. And I'd like to point out this is actually a very simple, mundane use of the copyright system. It's not all that magical the way people tend to describe it. In fact, it's pretty much what proprietary software companies do the same. They put requirements on you when you have their binaries that you're not allowed to redistribute them. In this case, you're allowed to redistribute them with some requirements. And this is where the issue of GPL violation comes in. Because by far, overwhelming majority, 99%, the violation that happens when there's a GPL violation is the separation of source code and binary and failure to provide the source code as the GPL requires. So that's why we had a compliance process in the first place, was this problem that people ship binaries to a customer and fail to give them complete and corresponding source code. So I want to talk a little bit about this issue of how you're allowed to produce binaries. As I pointed out, the source code's covered by copyright. Producing binaries is an activity that is governed by that copyright. And so you need permission to create those binaries, and you need permission to distribute them further. The GPL gives you that permission. In GPL version 2, that permission is found in section 3. In GPL version 3, that permission is found in section 6. And what it gives you is four different options for how you can distribute binaries, all of which require some mechanism by which the user receives the source code that corresponds to the binary. Now, I'm going to start using that term corresponding source code, which I'm going to talk about in detail later. But for the moment, while I'm talking about binaries, assume that there is this thing called the corresponding source code for a given binary. What I'm going to talk about now are the rules that you must follow when you distribute a binary with regard to the corresponding source code. The first option is the simplest, which is you can just give the source code alongside the binary, give them both at the same time. You can use an offer for source, which is also allowed by the GPL. I'm going to talk about each of these in detail in a moment. Now, these first two options are permitted by V2 and V3. The last two options are additional ways of doing source code provisioning in version 3. Specifically, you can do what I call side-by-side internet distribution, and you can do torrent distribution, which is a rarely used case, but is important because some people do want to do it. So why is my little thing popping up down there? It's annoying. So let's talk in detail about the first one, the source alongside the binary. This is by far the easiest way to do GPL compliance, and I urge all of you to think hard and long about whether or not you can do source code alongside the binary. If you can, you should do it. It's a hell of a lot easier than the other options. And people get so obsessed with the offer for source, which I'm going to talk about later, that they ignore that this really easy option is available to them. And the reason it's such a better option for you is that your obligations and requirements under the license are fulfilled upon your distribution to your customer or your user. If you give them the source code at the moment you give them the binary, you can forget about the GPL, assuming that it was complete and corresponding source code, which I'm going to talk about in a minute. Most of the other options put obligations on you that last longer than distribution time. So this option is really good if you're giving physical media to the user and it has enough space to fit the source code. So, for example, if you're an embedded hardware vendor, you're giving them, say, some handheld device, and you're giving a CD along with it, which has little applications and stuff, just put the source on the CD. It's a heck of a lot easier. Add it to the CD. That way, they all get it. If there's room on the hard drive on the device, just put it on the device. That's fine, too. So as long as you have the space and you're shipping media anyway, just use this option. It'll make your life easier. Now, there is this other option in there, which is the issue of offer for source. And it's in there precisely for that scenario where you've discovered you just don't have enough disk space on the device you're shipping to them. And then, on top of that, you weren't going to ship a CD anyway. So you're stuck with this, I have to give them source code, but it's going to increase my per unit cost because I have to put something on media. Well, instead, you can give them an offer for the source code to give it to them on physical media if they ask for it. And that way, you only have to produce the physical media for those people who were actually asking you for the source code, since you know most of your customers probably won't want the source code, but some will, and you have to, under GPL, provide for that. Now, the main problem with using the offer for source is that your offer has to be valid for 3 years after the last distribution you make. This can be a really long time in technology. Right? Many embedded devices, for example, only have a year and a half life cycle anyway. So you have to think about the fact that your year and a half life cycle ends. At the end of that, 3 years after that, which is two or three more product life cycles, you're still having to provide for source code to people who come to you asking for it. And note that you have to provide source code not only to your customers under the offer for source. Because of the way the GPL works, somebody who receives a binary version from you has permission under GPL to distribute it to someone else. So you have to, under version 2, be prepared to give the source code to anyone who asks you for it. And under version 3, anyone who is in possession of your binary. I should note here that version 3 is actually not as broad as version 2 in this case. It's a rather interesting fact. People love to talk about how version 3 is more restrictive. In fact, every example I'm going to show you here today is how version 3 is much more open and allows you to do more things. But either way, in this case, you've got to be prepared to give the source code to third parties who come asking for it, depending either whether they have the binary or just generally third parties. Under version 2, although not version 3, you have to be prepared to mail them a CD. Now, you can charge them your cost of producing the CD, which has to be reasonable. It's the word reasonable actually appears in the license. So that means you have to have a whole fulfillment process backing up this source code offer. It's a hell of a lot of work if you don't already have it in place. So again, this is why I stress, don't run to the offer for source like it's the best thing since sliced bread. Everybody wants to when they first hear about it, but it's not easier than including, if you can get away with just including. Now, I note again here that version 3 is more liberal. Version 3 allows you to do the source code offering on the internet and not have to do mail fulfillment. Version 2 requires the mail type fulfillment process. So again, here's a case where you're much better off in version 3 than you are in version 2. In addition to that, version 3 gives you two additional options for distribution for source code. The first one is actually one that we've always read version 2 to allow, although if you look at the text of version 2 in detail, it doesn't exactly allow this. And this is the case where you're only distributing on the internet. You only give your customers your software over the network, and you give them a binary that they download and install themselves. In this case, you can just put the source code right next to the binary on the same website or on an equivalent network service that you maintain. So this isn't really possible for embedded systems, which is the most common place we're finding GPL problems. But if you are that kind of, I just give you software to install on your own computer, you can do this internet distribution. Now, I really doubt, even though version 2 technically doesn't allow this, that you will ever have a violation, because I've made public statements for years that we meant the V2 to permit that. V2 was written in a time before internet distribution was common, and yada, yada, yada. But it is technically not allowed. So you have to worry about some very angry copyright holder that might be out there. I don't know if there is any, but there could be. So again, if you have the option to take your software under version 3, you should do it for yet another reason. The final thing that V3 allows is the issue of peer-to-peer file sharing for distribution. This is not used all that often. The only known case I know where this is being used is Canonical. When they ship new versions of Ubuntu, they offer a torrent for it. And this is, again, technically not allowed by version 2 for a variety of complex reasons, but it is, in fact, explicitly allowed by version 3 as long as you're providing a torrent for both the source and the binary. So if you like peer-to-peer file sharing, version 3 is your way to go. Now, I kept referring that, oh, you had to include the corresponding source code on the CD or whatever it is. So I've left you without a definition of corresponding source code, and that's what I would like to talk about now. The details, which you should read, everyone should read the license of corresponding source code, are under Section 3 in Version 2 and Section 1 in Version 3. And it's relatively straightforward. You have to make sure that all source code that makes the binary you're shipping is present. It's relatively simple from that point of view. Any source code that gets compiled into the binary that you're giving to someone and is part of that GPL'd whole, you have to give that source code to the user. And your revisioning system helps a lot here. I've got a ton of time at the end for questions, so I'm just going to hold them till the end. Your revisioning system helps a lot here because you can find the source code from your revision system, right? If you kept that vendor branch that I talked about and you kept all your modifications to the GPL software in your own branch, well, when you build that binary that you've been modifying from the software you've been modifying, you just give them the source code that you've been working on in your revision system. The more complicated part of the corresponding source code is the issue of giving them the installations instructions and other things they need to build the binary. This is a source of constant confusion. The language in V2 and V3 are somewhat different. The implications are basically the same. I have this little rule that I tell people when they ask me about this, is I say, just find somebody who understands this type of software. So if it's an embedded system, find somebody who knows embedded system development and see if they can build it from the instructions and scripts that you are going to give out. If they can build it, then it's surely adequate build instructions. The key here is to make sure that the user can actually make use of the source code you've given them in a real way for the application that you've given them. So they need to be able to make the binary, get that binary onto the device or whatever it is that you've given them. And it's really not much more complicated than that. If you have the build guru problem, you have one guy who knows how to build, just have them write out the instructions. You know, the version 2 is problematic in this regard because it talks about build scripts specifically. And the reason we've changed that in V3 to say installation instructions is we don't expect people to write build scripts when none existed. If you've got to stand on your head, run around the room, and sing to make the thing build, you don't have to write a program to do that. Just write in the README, to make this build, you must run around the room and sing and do whatever. It's fine for them, for the instructions to be in English for someone skilled in the art to be able to read and get the build working. It's not like you have to go back and write scripts when you didn't. I think you're, engineering-wise, you probably want to write some scripts just to make your own life easier, but if you don't want to, you can just write the instructions down in English. So I want to talk about the other side of the equation now, the folks who didn't bother to learn all this stuff first before they started distributing GPL stuff and screwed up. This is when you get that letter from a copyright holder or a copyright holder's lawyer that says, you appear to be in violation of the GPL and infringement of our copyright. And the key piece of advice that I have to give you, and it's only one thing, just stay in communication. Just answer the inquiry and talk in a friendly way to whoever contacts you and don't let that dialogue end. And I really think that there are probably no copyright holders out there, if you engage in a friendly dialogue and try to address their concerns as best you can, that you will be just fine. The only time that we have ever gotten aggressive, and this includes all the lawsuits we filed, was because there was no communication or communication broke down completely. Our rule for when we file a lawsuit is, Have they stopped answering our emails? Did they fail to ever even answer our email, our phone call, our letter? And that's when we have to do something to represent our clients as best as possible. But if you're communicating with the person who's accused you of a violation and you're doing your best to comply, for a decade we've been negotiating with violators and bringing them into compliance in this way, and it's going to continue that way ongoing for as long as I know, as long as I'm involved at least. But the thing you need to be aware of is that this license has teeth. So the reason you have to stay in dialogue and you have to communicate is because you are infringing copyright if you don't. The key piece of the GPL that makes enforcement possible is the termination provision. In version 2, that's in section 4. In version 3, it's in section 8. And the termination is the thing that makes it a big problem if you fail to comply. Because what it says is you have the right and permission from the copyright holder under copyright law to engage in the activities governed by that law, namely the right to copy, share, modify, and redistribute the software as much as you'd like, provided that you remain in compliance with the license terms. If you do not comply with the license terms, your right to do those things under copyright law is terminated. And in fact, this is yet another case where V2 is incredibly more aggressive and painful than V3. V2 automatically terminates your rights at the moment you do your first violation, even if it's a minor infraction. And that revocation of rights, that termination, is permanent until such time as a copyright holder restores it. It's pretty bleak from the point of view of a violator. This is why they so quickly want to settle when there's a problem, because they realize that they don't have any permission, or hopefully their lawyer tells them, you don't have any permission under copyright law to distribute this software package anymore, because you failed to comply with the terms of the copyright license. So if you're under V2, you have to be really worried to stay in compliance perfectly at all times. V3, yet another case, people talk about how bad V3 is and how hard it is, but V3 is easier here. V3 has terms for auto reinstatement of rights. Specifically, if you discover your own violation, you're like, oops, we screwed up, you can fix it yourself. And if in 60 days no copyright holder contacts you to complain, it's as if you never violated the license from the point of view of the termination provision. So you've got 60 days to sweat it, and then you're safe. It's as if you never violated at all. And even if you are contacted, if a copyright holder writes to you and tells you you're in violation, you have 30 days to correct the violation without penalty under the termination provision. Your rights go back to being restored. In any other case, you've got to get the copyright holder to reinstate them. You've got to say, look, I know I screwed up. What do I need to do to get back in your good graces? What do I need to do to get rights to distribute under the GPL again? So what I want to talk about now is the typical things that copyright holders ask for regarding reinstatement. And the key thing to think about here is the fact that most copyright holders of open source and free software have a primary goal that is very different from your company's goal. Their primary goal is to make a world where people share and improve software and make it better. That's why we write open source and free software. So you'll see that most of the requests on this list are related to that issue, not another issue. Specifically, one thing that copyright holders ask for immediately is not just compliance on their copyrights, but compliance on all your open source and free software stuff within your company. So the thing to note here is the given copyright holder only has a power under the law to enforce the license on the work that they wrote. But under Section 4, they can say, or Section 4 and V2, Section 8 and V3, they can say, look, I don't want to give you rights to distribute my copyrighted works again until you are treating all copyright holders right. And this is the very common request that you see from a copyright holder. It's good for you anyway, because chances were some copyright holder from another project was going to contact you anyway about the violation. So if when the first one contacts you, you come in compliance on everything, you're much better off. Another thing that copyright holders often want is a notification to past recipients who might have received a version of the software out of compliance. And this is there primarily to make sure, or people ask for this primarily to make sure that a user who didn't know they had rights on the GPL becomes aware. Again, it's about this issue of making sure users have rights and freedoms. And this is an issue of, hey, a user didn't know the freedoms that they had under the license. Let's make sure that they get information about the license and their rights. This other one is probably best attributed to my boss, Eben Moglen, as a term that we use. It's a really good idea, and it relates to the way the open source and free software community thinks. We ask, when there's been a violation, that somebody in the company with enough authority over the products be officially called a GPL compliance officer for that company. Our community is based around the idea of personal responsibility. Individuals write your software when you're using open source and free software, and each individual takes responsibility for the stuff they're in charge of. We found early on in doing compliance work that if there wasn't an individual inside the company who really wanted to take charge and handle GPL compliance issues, that they were just ongoing and happened again and again. So we started this idea of asking for somebody in the company to be the responsible party on all GPL issues. And this has worked out really well. So you'll frequently see copyright holders asking for this kind of a compliance officer to be assigned within the company when there's been a violation to try and make sure that more violations don't happen. The last thing I want to mention that copyright holders often want to see is some sort of compliance reports for some period of time after the violation. And this is primarily to make sure that the processes, particularly with regard to an offer for source, have been implemented properly and that people who are asking for source are getting it. So that's the kind of information that people would want to see in these compliance reports. Now, I want to talk about the biggest problem that I see today in GPL enforcement. And this is relating to the people who are a little bit clueless. So many times over the years, I've written, or whoever I'm working with has written to a violator and said, oh wait, it's not my fault. I had this upstream, you see. This upstream gave me this software, and I just put it in my device and shipped it, so it's not my problem. You're going to have to talk to my upstream. And then I was watching The Office a couple seasons ago, and I thought that this quote really fit what I'd been told all those years. So I urge you not to let your company turn into Dunder Mifflin, right? So if you are distributing some software, you need copyright permission to distribute it because it's copyrighted stuff, and you need some permission. The only thing that gives you permission in the case of a GPL program is the GPL itself. Your upstream can't give you permission for somebody else's copyrights that they don't own. So you need permission from the copyright holders to distribute, just like your upstream did. We never dispute that your upstream may be in violation. In fact, in my experience, the upstream usually is. And we are happy, all of us in the GPL enforcement world, to help you get your upstream into compliance so that you can be in compliance too. But it's not just their problem. You made it your problem when you chose to distribute their software. Your obligations are the same as your upstream's with regard to the GPL. Your obligations are, in fact, even broader because your upstream's shipping to a very small group of ISVs, and you're then shipping, in many cases, to a lot of end users, sometimes the entire public. So you've taken a problem that was small and made it bigger by propagating that distribution out of compliance. And this is something, Stormy talked about this in her talk, and I think it's really important. You've got to have a due diligence process with regard to all software in your organization, but particularly open source and free software. If you're talking about an upstream vendor to help you, for example, give you some software that'll run on your wireless router, you should ask them what's in that stuff. You should have a list of questions, in fact, you go to them with and say, what's in here? Who holds copyright on it? Where did you license it from? What was your license when you got it? Do you know of any GPL software that's in there? Do you know of any Microsoft software that's in there? Ask them all these questions and make sure they give you good answers. And if they don't buy from that upstream. It's generally the case that there are too good to be true open source vendors out there. There are a lot of vendors who give GPL-based software out of compliance, and they do it cheaply because they've sort of cut corners on their compliance processes, and therefore you may be actually buying yourself a GPL compliance problem because you save 10 cents per unit by going with that vendor versus the other. Make sure you ask them these questions. In fact, I think that the downstream should start requiring the upstreams to teach them how to comply. It's their job, after all. They're the ones who are trying to sell you this software and say, put this in your product, it'll make your product great. They should be saying, oh, and by the way, when you put it in your product, here's what you have to do. You should get at least a one-page sheet that explains your obligations under GPL when an upstream gives you some stuff. And Stormy mentioned this as well in a talk, that there should be indemnification from your upstream. I'm amazed at how often people are redistributing GPL software that they honestly and truly honestly did not know was in their product, yet they did not get any sort of indemnification from the upstream before they went and distributed. This is just, you know, bad business practice. You should require it. You should say, I want an indemnification if it turns out there's a copyright infringement in this product. And I'm not going to buy your product and redistribute it unless you give me that. Of course, you'll need to negotiate with them about that because they might not want to fully indemnify you, but they should be willing to do a little bit of it. And if they're not, you should be really skeptical about their product. The final sort of big issue I want to talk about, then I'll open up with plenty of time for questions, is this much-discussed issue of user products in version 3. It's primarily talked about in the end of section 6, and a lot of people have talked about how dangerous this is for the mobile space and the embedded space, and I think it's actually quite the opposite, and I can't let a talk like this go by without addressing the issue. The thing that is required by V3 is actually extremely reasonable and extremely simple for user product manufacturers. What V3 is requiring you to do is things that you would already probably have needed to do anyway, or things you would probably have faced anyway. I picked this picture. It's from ThinkGeek's website. They have a Our Products in Action section on their website. This guy's wearing this T-shirt that says, I void warranties. And he's taking apart some sort of horrible phone device or something. But this is what free software people do. They are technologically smart. They're interested in devices. And they take them apart and learn how they work. Particularly if there's GPL software in a particular device, they're going to have a lot of interest in how it works and how to change it and modify it. And I'll tell you quite frankly, they will figure it out no matter what you try to do with regard to DRM. They will. It's a matter of time. How long did it take for the iPhone to be unlocked? I think it was 48 hours. So the thing that you're required under the GPL with the user products exception is to just give them the ability to install their own version of the software, but it does something really useful for you as well as a distributor of a user product. You don't have to support them anymore. You get to void that warranty when they decide to exercise their rights under the GPL. In fact, you can ban them from your network if the software that they've modified causes a problem on your network. This is something that's not in version 2. So when people point to V3 in this case and say it's a big problem, I say, look, you're guaranteed by V3 that nobody's going to get mad at you or have a copyright infringement case against you if you said, I'm not supporting you anymore, you modified it under GPL. I'm not going to give you product updates because you modified under GPL. Your modified version messed with my cellular network, and you can't be on the cellular network with that modified version. GPL V3 lets you say those things, and GPL V2 doesn't. So when you hear people talk about user products stuff and why the mobile industry can't accept V3, think of this slide, please. Finally, I have to put this slide up because every question will be about it if I don't. It probably is going to be about it anyway, but I'm going to try. Derivative works just don't come up that much in GPL enforcement. That is a fact. Everybody loves to talk all the time about whether something is or is not a derivative work, and if it's a derivative work, it must be covered by the GPL. But the truth is, I've been doing enforcement for almost 10 years, and never has there been a dispute between the GPL side and the company side about whether or not something was or was not a derivative work. The reason this gets so much attention and I'll be quite frank here, is because copyright law is boring. And this thing, the GPL, and its use of derivative works in a novel way, is the darn most exciting thing to happen in copyright law in 20 years. And that's why so many lawyers are dying to talk about it, debate it, think about it, write big long papers about it, have big complicated theories about it, because it's new and exciting. It's just like if you're an engineer, like I am, a software developer, you want to work with the coolest, greatest, most interesting new technology. You know, when I discovered continuations in Scheme, I wanted everything to be a continuation. Fortunately, in Parrot, they are now. But the thing is, when you see a new idea in your field, you run to it. And that's what's happening with regard to the issue of derivative works in the GPL. Day to day, everything is pretty freaking mundane, okay? It's mostly, clearly, you modify the software, you opened it in an editor, started typing in the source code file that you got from the upstream. That's clearly a modified work. I've never met a copyright lawyer in the world who's disputed that. Or it's clearly you never were anywhere near any GPL stuff. You wrote your own binary that happens to run on Linux. Those are the two most common things, which are totally mundane uses of copyright law. Not fun to debate on the open bar mailing list, but it's what's normally happening. That's why I didn't spend this whole talk telling you about what is and is not a derivative work. And if you're in these dicey cases where you're trying to dance the line, is something a derivative work or not, then you're going to need a really experienced software copyright lawyer, not just a general copyright lawyer, but somebody who knows about software and copyrights, to look at the specific details of the situation you're in and give you a legal opinion about it. You're going to need that if you want to dance the edge of the GPL. And obviously, we represent the people on the GPL side. We're not going to give you opinions about this because it's not our job. We're advising the people who chose this license and they want things that are derivative works to be covered. We have a paper on our website about the issue of derivative works. We're going to put another one up soon. You can read those and see what we think, but in the end, you're going to have to ask your own lawyer if you want to dance the edge of somebody's license. That's true in the free software and open source world as much as it is in the proprietary world. And finally, the truth is, if somebody's at that point where they're dancing the edge of this line, they already understand all this other stuff and are doing it right anyway. So the main problem we're seeing is all the stuff I talked about up until now, and most of the industry seems to not get that yet. So let's focus on the education about those issues first, and then we can sit around and ask how many angels can dance on the head of a derivative work. I want to let you all know, to prepare for this talk, I wrote a paper, which turned out to be a 15-page paper, believe it or not. It's longer than it should be. We want to put that paper up as one of our resources on our website. It is not there yet, I have to sadly say. I sent to my colleagues, they wanted to do some edits, and it's now a collaborative document. But we have all gotten together and committed we're going to finish it by the end of the week. We expect it to be up by Thursday, so I'm going to try to hold really hard to that deadline. I'm going to be working on it tonight. So there's going to be a detailed paper discussing in the nits, nats, and lights of everything I've been discussing here. And finally, because I'm obsessed with this stuff, because I do it all day, I'm going to tell everybody that this talk was copyrighted by me, and I'm licensing it to you to make as many verbatim copies as you want. I know they're making a recording over here. You have a license to make and distribute verbatim copies of the talk or the slides as much as you like. I'm not giving you the right to modify them, primarily because I don't want you to misrepresent what I said.
I don't really think that speech was that dry.
Well, you didn't have to practice it all the times I did. Right? See, I actually, people don't know this, to become a good speaker, well, you can be Evan, right? Which means you're a good speaker just off the top of your head.
At any old time, on any old topic.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. At lunch, whatever. But he's really unique in that, and people have told me I'm a good speaker, and the fact of the matter is I'm only good when I've done that talk twice, mm-hmm. And I usually get up when I'm traveling and doing a talk. I get up in the morning, early that morning I'm giving it, and I do it twice in the hotel room before, and I record the first one and I listen to it while I'm in the shower.
See, that's
and then,
the piece that I never do.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
Probably very helpful. I practice it a few times within the couple of days, but
yeah, I give the whole thing, I record it, I play it while I'm in the shower, I get in the shower, I listen to it, and then I get out of the shower and then I practice it again. And that's the only way I can give good talks. I mean, it's not really magic. It's just like rehearsal.
But now, on the other hand, I was one of the lawyers that helped co-write that the compliance guide, which is now actually available on our website, and you can go take a look.
Oh, that's right. We were supposed to tell people about compliance, not speaking tips. Sorry about that. I get asked about sometimes. That's why it came into my head. Yeah, you're totally right.
I was going to say that actually, as someone who helped write the article. That
well,
we wrote
more than an article, really. I mean, it's
the
a
paper.
Real,
yeah.
I mean, it's a real.
Yeah,
I think
it's a guy.
It's substantive.
It absolutely is. But I wasn't bored when I listened to the talk. Yeah. So I guess that's what I was saying. Yeah. And I've encountered the material many times within our practice, but also in the context of writing the guide.
Yeah, and I think the guide has we've gotten some good feedback on it. It is very helpful. And so those of you that are in companies where you're using GPL software, you know, tell the folks in your legal departments and other places to take a look at the guide. We put a lot of work to try to make it as honest and straightforward as possible about how the GPL compliance process works and the problems that we see. And as you heard in the talk, they're much more mundane than you think. It's not all about, oh my gosh, you know, what does the GPL really mean? It's not about that. It's about the simple things of putting things in revision control and all that sort of stuff. So I encourage everybody to bring that around their companies. And if it's not as helpful as it could be, you're always welcome for feedback. If there's sections people want to see and that sort of thing, we'll always listen.
And you podcast listeners are on the fast track for getting questions answered by us.
That's true.
When we do get questions, we try to answer them within the podcast.
And we've only had the two, so.
Well, it's easy for us to be good at answering questions when we don't have that many.
Yeah, so and the address is podcast@softwarefreedom.org to write to us if you have questions. And we'll be back in 2 weeks.
Thanks for joining us.
Software Freedom Law Show is produced by Dan Lynch of HalfBakedMedia.com. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This show is released under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution No Derivative Works 3.0 United States license.